Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We are burning down the house yet again here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, October 2nd, 2011, and I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, bringing you another hour or so of talk about design, architecture, and the creative arts. In this case, I'm going to talk about energy in the built environment. In order, the fairly recent schism between the Passive House Institute, which is an international organization headquartered in Darmstadt, Germany, and the Passive House International United States branch. We'll talk about who, what, where, and where that goes a little bit. Part two, talk about the USGBC. And the fairly notorious lawsuit that was filed by Henry Gifford, who has been on our program here at Heritage Radio Network, and how that fell out. And then in the last part, I want to talk about emerging trends in terms of regulation here in the United States and internationally in terms of how we as architects and designers have to conform to a higher set of standards, increasingly, for energy conservation and energy stewardship, and what those trends are, and where some of the leading lights of the Good Green Movement think that we're going. There will be no guests today. It's just me. Before we get into who are the people and the players in the Passive House Institute and where do they stand for and where are they going in their quest for very low, not net zero, but very low energy consumption structures, let's have 3 minutes from the Who.
Back out of town.
Welcome back. I like that. There's got to be a better way. Now, the Passive House Institute in Darmstadt was founded by a German engineer, Dr. Wolfgang Feist, back in the 1990s. And the approach of Passive House, as opposed to, say, the Cascadia Building Challenge or any other attempt to have a zero energy, net zero energy structure, is that Passive House construction is very, very low energy consumptive. For those of you who are statistic freaks, what it means in terms of a house means that you would have walls with an insulation value of R40 or better. Now, those of you, my brothers and sisters, who are New York State architects, the current prescriptive code, that is, you know, if you're just following the chart for a house, is approximately R19. Round that up to 20, so twice as much insulation. And also, one of the features of a passive house is that there are very few air changes, because with an air change, heat is expelled or heat or humidity is brought in. One of the features of a passive house is humidity control and recovering heat. Dr. Feist has written that he considers the number one thing that you should install in a house if you're trying to make it more like a passive house is a heat recovery device, which means something that takes air, runs it through some gizmo, some sort of heat exchanging coils and so forth, to extract the heat. And then necessarily, and we'll get to that, bring that air back into the building and take that heat and distribute it into the cleaned up air. Why I say necessarily that the air would have to be cleaned up, because one of the other features of a passive house is that the air exchange rate, that is to say the amount of totally fresh air that is allowed to be brought into a house, is very low, less than one-half of the volume of the house every hour. Now you might say, well, gee, what's wrong with that? Well, let's take the case of a bathroom in New York City. A bathroom has to have three air changes per hour, just the bathroom. To get, you know, fresh air coming in and bad air being taken out. So passive house would be a very difficult thing to achieve in a New York City, an apartment house of any size, because we're not allowed by building code, for good reason, to recirculate toilet exhaust air. So to a certain extent, the passive house model really only works for single family houses out there in the landscape. And it, let me just read you some of the prescriptive requirements for passive house. A total heating and or cooling demand of less than 4.7 thousand BTUs per square foot per year. It's pretty low. The peak heating demand is under 3 BTUs per square foot. Wow. I mean, let's suppose you had a 2,000 square foot house, so that's a little bit more than 6,000 BTU. The stove on a decent in a decent apartment, you know, the one decent burner on a gas range in New York City could be 10,000 BTUs for a much smaller space. So that's a very small amount of heating. A huge amount of air tightness and a total primary energy source of less than, and that means for heating and lighting and everything else that's electrical in the house, of less than 38,000 BTUs per square foot per year. So So these are rather minimal. Now, what has happened between Passive House Institute of Darmstadt and the Passive House Institute of the United States is that Dr. Feist has decided that PHIUS, P-H-I-U-S, can no longer certify that buildings are Passive House compliant. He's taken issue with exceptions that have been made for American houses. And there are people who say, well, we've got the spirit going, but we can't do the things that you can do in Central Europe, where a winter temperature in Fahrenheit degrees is between 9 degrees and 16 degrees Fahrenheit at its worst. Here in New York City, almost every winter we get below 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and we often hit zero. Anywhere in the Northeast, we'll hit zero. In the Midwest, in the upper Midwest, temperatures at 10, 15, if you go up into Minnesota, which is a climate much like Sweden, routinely they have temperatures negative 35 Fahrenheit, 40 degrees negative Fahrenheit, routinely. And so Passive House doesn't work in Scandinavia, it doesn't work in Minnesota, or in a humid but moderate climate such as you have in the Northern California coast, San Francisco, and further north from there. It doesn't work either, because in those places, if it gets a little bit too warm inside your house, you open the window, and suddenly you've blown the air exchange ratio that's deemed acceptable. And in the winter, yeah, you really don't need a lot of heat, so you might make it there, but then in the winter you might even have the windows open just for fresh air. And the whole need for a mechanical ventilation system is moot. And so accommodations for the North American climate were being made by FIUS and Dr. Feist, because to a certain extent, Passive House Institute is his creation, and it's a one-man band at this point. Well, he can do what he wants to do with that, and they have decertified FIUS. This is a letter that was posted on the 2nd of September, not so long ago, by one of the FIUS certified practitioners. It has been more than 2 weeks now since Dr. Wolfgang Feist sent a letter to North American Passive House stakeholders announcing his decision to sever relationships with Passive House Institute US. Wow. I assume that anyone reading this can find endless and green building blogs and posts about this, so I need not go into details. And indeed, you may find all the notes and letters back and forth online, but I feel that as a certified Passive House consultant and the owner of a business dedicated to Passive House as a design standard and methodology, we need to make some statement with regards to the legitimacy of Passive House and how we intend to move forward as designers and NG consultants. The most important thing to say is that for the purposes of our work and the implementation of the Passive House standard, nothing has changed. The standard is science-based and dependable. And we have done and will do everything we can to be sure that our projects are planned, modeled, constructed in strict compliance with the standard. There may be some changes in certification of projects, whether to certify as North American Passive Houses or as International Passive Houses, but these will essentially be administrative decisions that should not affect the experience of clients or the quality of the buildings. The key will be, as always has been, with the accuracy of the energy model, the appropriate detailing, and the accurate accounting of site conditions. Well, that's all nice and touchy-feely, and I'm glad that that PHI certified consultant wants to, mend the rift between the U.S. and Germany in this regard. But those of us who are not really involved with in the Passive House movement can still learn a great deal from what Passive House details entail. For those of you who are architects, let me say that no thermal bridging is allowed whatsoever. That is to say that the exterior envelope must be in every area thermally isolated from the interior enclosure. What that means in practice is that there are 4 or more inches of high-density extruded polystyrene insulation that, well, which itself is a fairly, I hate this word, but it works, robust material. It'll sustain 60 psi of compressive strength. And if you put it under compression, then we don't have to worry about shear too much. And so what that means is a passive house could have 10 inches of insulation, some of it XPS, the extruded polystyrene, and the rest be, for example, a cellulose insulation. And in some cases, instead of a typical 2x6 stud, there could be 14-inch TJ engineered joists used as studs. Instead of as beams, set them on end and fill that enormous deep void with insulation. For sure, it means triple glazed windows. For those of you who are civilians, a double glazed window is you've got them in your house. There's 2 panes of glass. There's a space in between. Usually that space is filled with argon. And that space is all sealed up. Now, a triple glazed window means there's 3 layers of glass. There's a layer and a space, and then another insulated glass unit. If you want to get really high efficiency, then they'll make 3 panes of glass, each with its own inert noble gas in there, all sealed up, so that the R value, shall we say, is about 7. That's what the Phi standard requires. That's a U value, U being the inverse of R, of about 0.14. Now, the best windows that we are likely to see these days in our average projects here in New York and elsewhere in North America would be a U value of about 33, maybe 31, maybe 30. Very rarely anything below 30. Well, that's a performance. It's half as good as what the Passive House standard requires. And that's expensive because the North American manufacturing market hasn't caught up with the extreme demands that are being imposed in large part by building authorities in Central Europe, notably Austria, to a lesser extent in Germany. I don't know what the Swissies are up to, but they are there in Central Europe. And the Swiss have slightly more severe weather in their alpine regions, to be sure. But we'll keep tracking that. As to whether Phi and Phius get together and, you know, start playing together or not, I do not know. I think it's unfortunate. I think it's a little bit arrogant. Typical German stuff. I don't want to reopen the history of the 20th century. I think it's time for the Germans to bend a little bit and understand that not everybody has the same benefits as they have in their own place in the world and their own climate. But for sure, the rest of us who are not involved in the Passive House movement can certainly learn a great deal from that. Now, something that has a lot of traction in North America and all over the world is the green building movement. Recently, I was very happy to meet David Gottlieb, who was the founder of the United States Green Building Council. He and Rick Federici got that going almost 20 years ago. And there's great cause for celebration at the USGBC. because of the settlement over a rather extreme case of disagreement from the building community. Those of you who are longtime listeners may remember, or may not, when we had Henry Gifford here. Henry's an energy sort of guru and a self-trained engineer here in Brooklyn. And he spoke on episode 12. If you can go to the brand new heritageradionetwork.com site, much improved, excellent, you will see in episode 12, an episode titled Lead, Energy, and Everything in Between. We had a conversation with Henry Gifford and Gennaro Brooks Church about their discontents with the USGBC and the LEED system, L-E-E-D. But before I get into that, I have to say that Henry's karma has caught up with him rather quickly. Let's have a little bit of John Lennon. So karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right in the head. You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead. What in the world you thinking of? Laughing in the face of love. What on earth you trying to do? It's up to you. Yeah, you. Instant karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right in the face. You better get yourself together, darling. Join a human race. How in the world are you gonna see? Laughing at fools like me. Who on earth do you think you are? A superstar? Well, the USGBC will shine on. Henry's had his comeuppance. Henry sued the USGBC and also the principals of the USGBC, the founders and the chief executives, for $100 million, alleging racketeering. Solely on the grounds that they had created an environment that if you were not a LEED AP, that is to say a LEED accredited professional, that you were going to get hired and Henry was not going to get hired because Henry had no intention of becoming a LEED AP. And if you listen to episode 12, Gennaro will tell you his feeling about test taking and what that really meant, and did you really know anything that you didn't know before? And there was a lot of discussion and a lot of discontent. Well, what has happened is that the judge dismissed Henry's amended suit. There was some negotiation and he amended his lawsuit, but it was still a class action suit. Now, of course, LEED is about more than just energy, but Henry's main beef was the assertion that LEED buildings perform more effectively and efficiently in terms of energy consumption. And he had statistics that suggested that that was not necessarily the case. Now, LEED is about more than just energy. It's about the use of local materials. It's about the use of materials that are renewable. It's about interior air quality. It's about alternative technologies now. It's a multiphasic approach to a good green building. It's not just about energy. And so, to a certain extent, Henry's lawsuit was not really fair. But the fact of his bringing the lawsuit did bring changes, and now the USGBC is looking post-certification at the actual efficiency statistics of constructed buildings that were given LEED certification, either certified or silver or gold or platinum. And that's a good thing. I think there should be a lot more transparency. That was another of Henry's beefs, that USGBC had the data and they just weren't giving it up. They were cherry-picking the data that they did publish. For sure, that smacks of obscurity. And if anything, the Good Green Movement should be about transparency, I believe. Because the more that we know from each other, from our own experiences about how the different strategies that we employ to make our buildings more efficient, better, healthier places to work and live in, the better the world's going to be. One pundit online had this to say about Henry's lawsuit. To the best of my research, Mr. Gifford is not a LEED AP, and true, and indeed from his website and publications, he has outspokenly denounced the USGBC and LEED. His case does not appear to own any property certified by LEED. In short, USGBC's actions have not harmed him and his career. If anything, has been enhanced by the USGBC's position. When he amended his lawsuit, it was questioned how he could prove he was harmed by the alleged false advertising. It turns out that this was one of the lawsuit's major and fatal flaws. A plaintiff that brings a lawsuit must show standing, that is to say, you personally were harmed, to prove that the right person is bringing the suit. Since his allegations fell under the Latham Act, he had to satisfy two tests to show standing. That's interesting. We can get to that a little bit later about who can bring a suit and whether they have personally been harmed apropos of the application of the Federal Fair Housing Act, which prohibits discrimination against persons with disabilities, especially as pertains to the built environment. We'll get to that later, perhaps, or in a subsequent episode. In the cases involving the FHA, that is the Fair Housing Act, we've heard stories that there were packs of venal and litigious lawyers who were suing building owners over violations under the Fair Housing Act. And these lawyers don't represent anybody who's actually been harmed, and indeed they're not even proving that anyone's been harmed, but rather only that the buildings don't have full accessibility under an interpretation of the Act. But we'll get to that later. In any case, it was a good thing for the USGBC that this lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. It means Henry cannot bring it back in any form whatsoever. But it did, I think, fairly bring about some useful, if not needed, self-assessment amongst the principal players in the United States Green Building Council. But indeed, you know, it is a wild world. I think I want to get into the FHA enforcement in this wild world. So, Jack, could I have a couple minutes of wild world?
Now that I've lost everything to you, you say you want to start something new, and it's breaking my heart you're leaving. Maybe I'm grieving, but if you want to leave, take good care. Hope you have a lot of nice things to wear. Then a lot of nice things turn bad out there.
The Federal Fair Housing Act is a federal law, and for the longest time it was understood by some of us that if you're not receiving federal funds for a project, you didn't need to conform to it. And to the extent that it is a commercial building, you don't have to conform to the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1991, for sure, for sure. But it's a federal housing act, which means that the feds have made it very clear lately, especially, that all buildings of a certain class must be accessible to one degree or another to people with physical disabilities. And that is freaking us out. Case in point, in New York City in 1987, as the city council is wont to do, there was a local law passed, Local Law 58 of 1987. It was an accessibility law, which adopted a modified version of the standards that were subsequently enacted as the rule book under the Americans with Disability Act of 1991. Now, the ADA, Americans with Disability Act, for sure applies to public buildings. Now, what Local Law 58 of 1987 applies to is housing, of which we have a lot in New York. And some of the modifications that the New York Local Law 58 enacted allow much smaller bathrooms and kitchens and clearances for principally wheelchairs than the master code. I know this could be rather confusing, which is the American National Standards Institute, A117.1. So there's ANSI, and that goes back to the 1960s, and that's a master code for accessibility. And the ADA in 1991 adopted ANSI and added a few other things for transportation facilities. In 1987, New York's Local Law 58 adopted ANSI A117.1 with a few modifications that were less stringent because New York apartments tend to be smaller than apartments in other places, and they're trying to make it work so that in good faith we New Yorkers could do the right thing for people in wheelchairs. All right, so now, lately, within the last month and a half or 2 months, there's been announced a settlement where the Department of Justice, you know, Eric Holder, the Attorney General and his department, brought an action against a major property owner under failure to observe the Fair Housing Act. Now, the Fair Housing Act has its own design manual. So we've got ANSI, we've got the ADA, we've got Local Law 58, and we have the Fair Housing Act design manual. Sounds confusing, doesn't it? Believe me, we've spent a lot of time trying to figure it out in the practice in which I'm engaged right now, and we're not quite clear which in any particular case is the most stringent, because we really would like to do the right thing. Also, there's nothing like being sued. It's kind of like what Dr. Johnson said, nothing focuses the mind like being hanged. But I understand that one gets used to it after a while. Well, we don't want to go there. We'd like to do the right thing. And we find that the Fair Housing Act's design manual in its various iterations had more stringent requirements than even ANSI had, and certainly far more stringent than Local Law 58 in New York City had. Now, all of this will be resolved in the future when all future projects in New York City are filed under the 2008 Building Code, which adopts the International Building Code provisions, which adopt ANSI as of 2003, and the FHA, which is administered, the Federal Housing Act, which is administered and enforced by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, has finally reconciled with ANSI. So those of you who are civilians who are listening to this, I know I lost you probably 10 minutes ago, but for those of you who are my brothers and sisters in the architecture world, there's a lot more that we could talk about. It's confusing. It's a little scary. We try to do the right thing. We try to create new, wonderful architectural expressions while being mindful of the various conflicting regulatory requirements. And we really don't like getting smacked down after having done our very best to try to make the best of the mad world. One last thing before I bid you adieu this afternoon. You know, when it's just me talking, I can only really talk for about 45 minutes before I get tired of listening to my own voice. It's true. I did want to talk about what might be up, getting back to the topic of energy, a little bit about the Green Building Conference that's coming up and some prognostications about where the world of energy conservation is headed. Let's have a couple minutes of Mad World. All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for their daily races, going nowhere, their tears are filling up their glasses, no expression, no expression, have my head, I want to drown my sorrow. Down the house on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and it is a mad world, but we love it. Love it, love it, love it. Coming up this next week, Tuesday, October 4th through the 7th in Toronto, Canada, The Canadians will be having, will be hosting the next annual Green Building Conference, Green Build. Last year, the pundits and experts predicted looking forward in 2011. Let's see how they did. for all the discussion about the legal implications of legislating green, well, Chicago adopted LEED standard, USGBC's LEED standard, as mandatory for all city-owned construction projects, and New York City also followed suit. So that perked up. There have been surprisingly few challenges from the private sector. Well, duh. It does add 8 to 10% of cost to a building to do good green. And when you're in a depression, and believe me, so many of our colleagues are still un- or under-deployed. Let us not forget for one moment that those of us who have any sort of income are exceedingly lucky. It's our politicians who tell us that this is just a great recession and a double dip. Bullshit. It's a depression. Own up to it. This job stimulus that the president has just finally, 3 years too late, proposed that would do something for those of us in the construction industry is too late, too little, and does really nothing for those of us who are creators, designers. Nothing like the federal art project that we had in the first depression within our memory. Nothing like the CCC, which are friends who like to do things out in the green, that is to say the planting world, would have liked to have been part of the Civilian Conservation Corps, planting trees, making roads, or the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, would have been nice to bring back. Let us improve what little beauty there is in the public sector, please. No, that's not part of it. I got off my track. This was about energy. Private sector. No, yeah. Some of the bigger corporations are seeing that it's a good thing to do good green, and we have to applaud that. Point two, the pundit said, reports of more lawsuits against green building developers because they didn't achieve the LEED ratings that they said that they were going to achieve. Well, it's a slippery thing. You shouldn't promise something before you've got it. You can't say, well, we're going to have a LEED platinum building and entice people to buy in because they think that that is something that they really must have. Well, they probably should have it, but don't make that part of your sales pitch if you're not absolutely sure that you can't deliver it. Been several actions brought in that regard, and so it would probably get settled under the terms of, well, we were a little bit over enthusiastic. Limitations of LEED as a legislative tool. Well, you know, here's a trend. As more and more governments or governmental authorities, cities, towns, nations see the need for good green, they are looking more towards a traditional approach of making it a matter of law. There is the International Code Council, the ICC, not to be confused with the UCC, which is United States Uniform Commercial Code. The ICC, also not to be confused with the Interstate Commerce Commission in the United States, the International Code Council, publishes the International Building Code, which then is adopted in different flavors by individual jurisdictions. So New York City now has an IBC code from 2008 going forward. So projects that are filed under the new building code in New York will have to accommodate the ANSI standards, the adaptability standards, but still not the International Building Code's good green, what do they call it? The Green Construction Code, which is an energy code and also a sustainable material code. But they see a trend towards having the green code applied as a legal requirement, which kind of cuts the USGBC out of it, which is probably a good thing because the USGBC, some of us have seen the whole LEED process as adding a layer of external experts who have to be LEED certified, who have to create a whole database of information to submit to the USGBC in order to obtain a LEED certification for a project of whatever type, you know, certified, silver, gold, platinum. It's a lot of paperwork. If being green meant a matter of conformance to an IBC code, we as architects certify that we're in conformance with applicable codes every day of our professional lives, and that would just cut a whole lot of having to prove things out of the equation. Yes, we'd still have to provide an energy model and other documentation, but it would really diminish the amount of extra burden of documentation, which is a good thing because our fees are so very low compared to everybody else on the soft cost side. That is to say, the non-directly related to nails, bolts, planks, concrete, light fixtures. That's direct cost. We're on the soft cost side, indirect cost side, and our percentage of the total aggregate cost to a developer or owner on the soft cost side is infinitesimal compared with the insurance costs, the lawyers, the real estate brokers. Our fee is mostly, most of the time, for most of us architects, is lower than the real estate professional gets for selling the property. We could debate the fairness of that some other time. I'll get an insurance person in here, and they all talk about how it is that they show many, many, many projects, buildings, and they don't make any sales, and then when they do make a sale, it offsets the ones that they get. Guess what? For us, we talk to many, many, many potential owners, and the ones that we do get are very few. And their fees are 5 or 6%. And a lot of the owners can bid us down, us architects, because they view our services as a commodity. And there are those amongst us who will do a project for 2 or 3% of the cost of construction. Has been that way for 150 years. Hasn't changed any. But here's what's coming up in Green Build 2011. The U.S. Green Building Council's annual conference and expo is making its way to Toronto. Funny that the U.S. is going to Toronto, but okay. I guess the exchange rate must be favorable to the U.S. dollar. I don't know. To celebrate what's next in green building, held in conjunction with Canada Green Building Council's annual festival. It will, here are the really highlights of the event, as it says here in the press release. Speeches by New York Times columnist, the Pulitzer-winning Thomas Friedman. I don't know what his credentials are as relating to construction or architecture. Yeah, but never mind. ABC's news division political commentator Cokie Roberts. Oh, it gets better. Our own New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Yeah, he's got a lot of experience with good green. Why, you know, Mayor Bloomy has private jets that he flies at 40,000 feet, you know, leaving jet exhaust in the stratosphere. Great. Yay. So anyway, those of you who have, $2,000 to blow on going to Green Build, I'm sure that you'll be up there. The Canadian government estimates that it'll bring in something like $58 million to Toronto. That's pretty good, eh? It's pretty nice. It comes out to about $2,000 a person. And but I do hope to hear something really wonderful and new coming out of that whole experience. Well, I've exhausted myself with my latest Jeremiad. I do appreciate your listening. This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith. We'll be right back.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market.